From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Stephen McCauley. His new comic novel, Alternatives to Sex, is about a gay 40-something real estate agent addicted to house cleaning and to cruising the internet for casual sex. Both obsessions are symptoms of post-September 11th trauma, or what he calls makeshift anxiety management and fatalism of the better-get-it-while-you-can variety. McCauley's best known for his 1987 novel, The Object of My Affection. Also, New York Times business writer Louis Uchitel talks about his new book, The Disposable American. It describes how layoffs became standard management practice and what the consequences have been. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new novel, Alternatives to Sex, William Collins, the main character, confesses that for much of his life, his addictive behavior had been of the most deeply shameful kind, obsessive cleaning. Vacuuming, ironing, even secretly cleaning a sink or bathtub when having dinner at a friend's house. Then he added promiscuity to his list of obsessions. The novel is a social comedy about why and how he decides to end that obsession and practice celibacy. William is a gay man in his mid-40s who works as a real estate agent near Boston. Reviewing the novel in Entertainment Weekly, Jennifer Reese described it as a sweet and funny book, nearly perfect. My guest is the author of Alternatives to Sex, Stephen McCauley. His other novels include The Man of the House and The Object of My Affection, which was adapted into a movie starring Jennifer Aniston and Paul Rudd. Let's start with a reading from the beginning of Alternatives to Sex.
My decision to practice celibacy had nothing to do with prudery or penance, morality or manners, dysfunction or fear of disease. It had very little to do with sex. It was all about real estate. What had started out 1 year earlier as about a benign computer dating, a euphemism for online chatting followed by brief encounters, less impersonal and old-fashioned anonymous sex because you exchanged fake names with the person, had turned into an almost daily ritual that had replaced previous pastimes such as reading, going to the movies, working, exercising, eating. I'm exaggerating, of course, but by how much I'd rather not say. For months, I'd known that my habits were slipping out of control, but I figured that as long as I acknowledged my behavior was a problem, it wasn't one. And then one rainy September morning, I woke up and decided that too much really was enough. I could feel trouble pressing down on me like the low, dark sky outside my bedroom window. Do something about your life, I told myself. A directive that's usually, in my case, translated as stop doing something.
That's Stephen McCauley reading from his new novel, Alternatives to Sex. Stephen McCauley, welcome back to Fresh Air. How would you describe why your character decides to give up sex?
Well, the reason he claims is because he can't stand any more walking into people's grim, badly furnished apartments anymore. It's just become too depressing to him. That's the rationale that he uses. I think closer to the truth is that he can't stand this combination of physical intimacy and emotional detachment, which is what he keeps encountering on these online meetings.
Your book is set after September 11th. How does that affect your character's decision to try to be celibate?
Well, you know, he says at one point that after September 11th, everyone was trying to decide between doing whatever it took to combat the collective evil of mankind and do good, and on the other hand, putting all altruism aside and just doing whatever it took to feel good. And this is the conflict, this sort of moral dilemma that the main character in this book finds himself in at the beginning. And I think it's something that, you know, a lot of people that I know were feeling after September 11th. And one of the inspirations for this book was that I had this friend who called me up shortly after September 11th, and he told me, you know, he said, how are you doing? And he said that he was giving up his mistress because the whole crisis and tragedy made him realize what was important to him, which was his wife and his family. And a few months later, I bumped into him on the street, and he was with this mistress of his. And, you know, and then later he said to me, well, you know, I realized after September 11th that, you know, we could all die at any minute. And the most important thing is to do whatever you can to enjoy the day and seize the moment. And it was a little bit of that kind of moral confusion that I wanted to capture in the book.
That's great. Were you going through that at all in your own life?
Yeah, I think I was. I mean, of course, you know, like everyone, I sat watching this and feeling that something big had happened, something had really changed, and that nothing would be the same. And then, you know, after a few months, it was like, well, yeah, but what exactly has changed, and what is different? And And you know, like a lot of writers, I know the question quickly became, how am I going to write about this? And can I really write my domestic comedies and little comedies of manners in the aftermath of this? And for me, the decision that, yes, of course I can, was really finding ironies like that in the way people were responding to it, which I found very funny and on another level kind of touching.
Now, your character is also a realtor, so, you know, he's addicted to finding men through the internet, and he's also dealing with people who are selling and buying homes. So he's dealing with people selling and buying their homes and people selling and buying each other.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a lot of similarities because as a real estate agent, he's invited into people's houses and he gets to look at what's in their cabinets and their closets and their medicine chests. And it's a very intimate kind of profession. And people reveal a great deal about themselves. And it's the same way, you know, that he meets these guys online and then he goes into their houses. And so it's another way of getting into people's lives.
Now, you know, both the online dating and the real estate profession have a lot to do with writing. I mean, what I mean is, in online stuff, you're selling yourself. I mean, you're flirting through your language or through your personal ad. And in real estate, like, you're selling your home through the way your house is described in the classifieds. Have you given a lot of thought to how they compare and differ in the style of writing that they use?
Well, that's a really perceptive question because they're very similar. You know, the essential quality of most real estate ads, as far as I can tell, is taking a potential minus and turning it into, you know, this great advantage, saying, you know, tremendous potential. And the language of real estate ads is very coded. And once you begin looking at them carefully and researching them a little bit, you can tell, you know, right away what it means when it says it's a cozy apartment. Well, that probably means it's 300 square feet. And there are similar codes that people use in their online dating ads, you know, to describe themselves in the best possible light, which usually means some kind of exaggeration or evasive language.
And they're both about, like, evoking fantasies. You know, fantasies of what your new life will be in your new home or fantasies of what your love life will be with this new person.
Yeah, exactly. Especially in real estate, I just know so many people who are completely obsessed with real estate these days, which is one of the reasons I wanted to write about a real estate agent. And the people that I used to spend an enormous amount of time talking about, you know, the ways that they were going to fix up their lives by finding the perfect spouse or the perfect partner or fix up their relationships by doing this or that, it just seemed to me that suddenly they stopped talking about all of that and were talking about, you know, how they're going to buy a better apartment or they were going to fix up their house. And everything got shifted onto real estate. And I'm not sure if that's a product of age. It probably is. But there was almost like a kind of giving up trying to fix your personal life and just going straight for the concrete details, like, you know, a better house, which is... But what they were really talking about, of course, was, you know, my life will be better if I move into a better condo or if we rehab the kitchen and, you know, that kind of thing.
Now your character who's trying to be celibate and give up his online online dating.
Yeah, dating.
Dating sounds so prim, doesn't it?
It does, really.
But anyway.
I think that's what he really wants, actually. Uh-huh. I think he really wants to be dating someone and talking to them and so on. Instead, he shows up and there's a 40-minute encounter that has some physical intimacy. And then in the aftermath of that, he'll say, you know, oh, gee, you've got a tan. Have you been on vacation? And the person he's with will say, oh, that's kind of a personal question, don't you think? And it's that sort of thing that really gets to him.
Well, you know, you write about your character. During the period of his promiscuity, he was embarrassed and would keep intellectual books on his night table to make it seem like he spent his nights at home catching up with Simone de Beauvoir. But when he was monogamous, it made him feel unmanly, and he'd cover up and try to leave the impression he was leading a wild, promiscuous life. Could you talk a little bit about being uncomfortable with both sides, with both ends?
You know, I think there is some of us who are uncomfortable with whatever we're doing. And, you know, that if you're being promiscuous, it seems like it's a bad thing somehow. And you know, and if you're being monogamous, then, you know, that seems unmanly, that you should be more aggressive sexually. And, you know, what's wrong with me that I'm able to be faithful, you know, for a long period of time. And so that's the kind of character that this is. And those are the sort of ironies of people's behavior and attitudes towards themselves that I just love writing about.
My guest is Stephen McCauley. His new novel is called Alternatives to Sex. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. I guess it's Stephen McCauley, and his new novel is called Alternatives to Sex. Your character, William, is also obsessive about cleanliness, about cleaning and ironing. He'll even do other people's ironing because he's so into it. Why did you create him that way?
I love the idea of someone whose emotional life is basically a mess, who spends enormous amount of times cleaning up their physical surroundings. And I did a lot of, well, I don't know, I wouldn't say a lot of research, but I did do a certain amount of research into cleaning, you know, and there are volumes, Terry, of books out there about the proper way to house clean. And there's a great book called Home Comforts by Cheryl Mendelson, which is about 900 pages, and it tells you everything you ever need to know about the way to fold fitted sheets and so on and so forth. And then there's a whole subcategory of books that tell you how to clean the house with a lot of food products for some reason. It's like you can use lemonade mix and Coca-Cola to clean the sink. And I began buying a lot of this stuff and doing a lot of house cleaning using these products, which seemed completely insane. And after a while, I figured, you know, and there's something about it, it's sort of this alchemy, you know, that you're taking a product that's designed for one thing and using it for a completely other purpose. And it seemed really interesting and really amazing to me. And then, you know, one morning I decided it would really just be easier to use Ajax instead of hauling all this food out of the cabinets and, you know, trying to wash the bathtub with it.
So
I don't know if that answers the question.
Do you do a lot of cleaning yourself at home?
I do a fair amount. I'm a pretty messy person, but I do like to clean. It gives the illusion that, you know, you've really accomplished something when you've cleaned the bathtub or something. In fact, it's one of the reasons that I almost never write at home, because I find that I'm often, you know, house cleaning instead of writing.
Is it incompatible for somebody to be obsessive about, you know, cleaning their surroundings, you know, a sparkling kitchen, a totally clean bathroom, dining room, and at the same time have lots of sex with strangers? They have no idea who these people are.
I think it's completely in keeping. I think that people compartmentalize their lives and don't make those sort of connections, or because they feel a little bit uneasy about that, you know, entering a stranger's house and having physical contact with them within 10 minutes, then they go home and try and do a Lady Macbeth routine, you know, and clean the sink and start vacuuming obsessively. So,
One of the men who your main character sees is, you describe him as a right-wing nut whose politics were in such conflict with his erotic appetites. It felt almost like my moral duty to have sex with him from time to time to point out to him what a hypocrite he was. Do you know people like that?
Absolutely.
People whose politics and sexual behavior are completely at odds with each other.
You know, I have a couple of friends who are married who are out having sex with other men at the same time. And there's something about the internet that makes this kind of behavior possible and in a way, you know, safe, quote unquote, because you don't have to really reveal your identity and so on. And these are just people I, you know, actually talk to and have friendships with. And one of them, when the issue of gay marriage came up in Massachusetts, which is where I live, just took such a hard line on it, you know, about that this was destroying the family and the sanctity of marriage. And, you know, this is someone who had just told me these lurid stories about how he'd spent his weekend connecting with people online and so on. And that kind of hypocrisy is just something that I find, you know, completely appalling and outrageous and at the same time sort of hysterically funny, to tell you the truth. So.
No, your main character's closest friend, Edward, you describe him as the only child of a pair of religious fanatics. Why did you make his parents religious fanatics?
I wanted to have a character who's was, in a way, a little bit damaged by this religious fanaticism because he is rejected by his parents and they make life very difficult for him. And at the same time, he just wants to continue trying to please them and makes great efforts at taking care of them when they're sick and they're elderly and so on. And, you know, I think that this is true for a lot of people, maybe especially true for gay kids who are raised in families where there's this kind of religious fanaticism. It's very damaging. It's very hurtful in a lot of ways. And it seems so completely out of keeping with the at least in theory, the principles that the family is trying to live by.
Let me read something that your character says about his thoughts on religion and spirituality. He says, "For the most part, I'm baffled by spirituality. Religion, spirituality's sturdier cousin, has its drawbacks, for example, being the cause of 85% of violent conflict in the world. But at least religions have specificity, systems of punishments and rewards that are spelled out in detail. Religions have a narrative driving them, and they have, in some form or other, God, that main character to end all main characters." Do you agree with your character here about religion and spirituality?
Yes. You know, I think one of the reasons I write is because I like putting my opinions and observations on things into my novels and into the mouths of these characters who resemble me in some ways but in most ways do not. But yeah, you know, lately my view of religion is just I'm really baffled by people's attitudes towards religion and the way they use it as an excuse for so many things. And also, again, you know, after September 11th, it seemed that people were becoming more religious. And when it seemed to me, well, gee, isn't that the one of the causes of this problem right now? And as for spirituality, I really have no idea most of the time what people are talking about when they talk about spirituality and they say they're on a spiritual quest. And it usually involves some slightly tacky elements like, you know, scented lavender pillows and weird music that's completely atonal. And I don't know. It's just stuff I don't really get. So.
Have you ever had religion or spirituality in your life?
I was raised Catholic, so I'm not sure what that means. I'm not a particularly religious person, and I don't know if I'm spiritual or not because I don't really know what spiritual means. I spend an enormous amount of time doing yoga, and I have since I was about 15 years old. And the only one of the main drawbacks of it for me is when I see people kind of, you know, gazing off into the distance with this blank stare as if they're having a kind of religious experience, when it seems to me it's a perfectly interesting and useful way of exercising, and I can't take it too much further than that.
Stephen McCauley's new novel is called Alternatives to Sex. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with the new website at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, the disposable American. Louis Uchitel talks about layoffs and their consequences. And more with novelist Stephen McCauley. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Stephen McCauley. His new novel, Alternatives to Sex, is about a 40-something gay real estate agent who's obsessed with cleaning and with cruising the internet for casual sex. The novel follows his attempt to give up the second obsession and become celibate. Macaulay is also the author of The Object of My Affection, which was adapted into a movie starring Jennifer Aniston and Paul Rudd. How old were you when you came out, and was it a big deal in your life, or was it kind of obvious and everybody already knew and was comfortable with it?
No one was comfortable with it at all. I think I was probably about 16 when I realized what my sexual inclinations were, you know, in my own head, and sort of made peace with it. And I saw it as somehow or other connected to all the political turmoil and the social movements, you know, feminism and civil rights in the 70s. And then when I began the process of coming out in a more public way, such as, you know, to my family, I was probably about 19 or 20. And that was very difficult, and it was very painful. My parents, who have always been extremely loving and supportive and very warm people, were somewhat conservative politically and had a little, you know, religious Catholic way of thinking about things, and it was very difficult, and there were several years of where we didn't communicate very much, and you know, I lost contact with one of my brothers for a number of years, and so it was kind of a painful experience in a lot of ways.
Well, did your parents ever have the attitude that if you really cared about your family, you would change?
Yes, actually, that was stated in those terms, and fortunately, I didn't really see that as an option, and so I just kind of felt, well, you know, this is really who I am, and it's funny because I always think of myself as having, you know, incredibly low self-esteem, and not much of a sense of who I am, but I think the reality is that. It's sort of like being a writer. You know, I find it very difficult, and I think this is a totally crazy profession. And every once in a while, I sort of haul out these materials about, you know, applications to nursing schools and so on and so forth. And but I guess, you know, there's something in me that makes me feel like, you know, this writing is really what I want to do and what I have to do, and that being gay is just an integral part of my personality and who I am, and probably has been since birth.
How old were you when you knew you wanted to write?
I think I probably always knew that I wanted to write. I was always reading when I was a kid, and I was always writing when I was a kid. But it wasn't something that was especially encouraged in my family, oddly enough. And I think it was seen as a little bit subversive because no one else in my family really read for recreation. And so I was always being told, you know, put down that book and why aren't you watching TV like the rest of us and that kind of thing. And but it seemed like a very audacious goal, you know, to want to write books. And so it took me until I was in my probably mid-20s to begin to do it seriously.
Did you have any writing jobs before you started writing books?
No. Before I started writing books, I taught kindergarten and I worked in a travel agency for a long time. But no, I really avoided writing in every possible way. And I teach off and on. Right now I'm teaching at Brandeis. And I tell my students that, you know, when I was in college, and this is really true, every semester I would sign up for a writing class and I'd go to the first class and they'd say, and, you know, and go home and write something and bring it in next week. And I would rush down to the registrar and drop the class because it was just so intimidating to me. So I avoided it for a long time.
Your writing is really funny, and your perceptions about people just really make me laugh. Are you able to, like, go through life that way, too? Does life often seem like a comedy to you, or is it only when you sit down to write that you can force it to be funny?
You know, like a lot of people I know who write things that they intend to be comic, I'm really depressed most of the time and, you know, sort of drag myself through my days and never find what I'm writing even remotely funny because the process of putting it down on paper is so painful to me. So I guess no. But on the other hand, taking a comic or ironic point of view on things has always been my number one defense against things that make me uncomfortable or unhappy. And so, I don't know, maybe I've just contradicted myself.
Well, no, as a matter of fact, I want to read one of your sentences that combines the depression that you say you have with your humor. And this is about antidepressants. And your character says, "I was embarrassed by the fact that I wasn't taking any mood-altering drugs myself. It seems so arrogant not to be these days." I think that's hysterical.
Well, you know, I took antidepressants for about 6 months. And the reason I took antidepressants was because everybody I know is taking antidepressants, and everybody's saying that, you know, they just felt like finally they tapped into their full potential and they had become, you know, the person that they could become. They'd become the best that they could be. So I took antidepressants for about 6 months, and I thought, you know, if I have finally tapped into my full potential and become the best I can be, that is really depressing. So I had to get off those pills right away.
One more thing, and again, I'm going to quote your main character, William, and he says, and I want to remind our listeners that, among other things, he's obsessed with cleaning and with other men, and he says, "I always tried to give the impression that I was above superficial concerns about age, weight, sex, laundry, and most of the other things I was obsessed with." And that just leads me to wonder, did you ever go through a period of writing where you thought, you shouldn't be writing about certain types of social comedy that other people might think of as being shallow in their concerns. You should tackle, like, the great issues of the day.
Terry, that's why it takes me, you know, 5 years to write a book, because I think there's a part of me that assumes, you know, if I'm writing this, it must be shallow and insignificant. And so therefore, I have to, you know, stop and start all over again. And at a certain point, my deadlines just, you know, there are so many deadlines piling up behind me that I've missed that I just have to forge ahead. But yeah, I mean, I really like writing about the daily lives of rather ordinary, not particularly heroic people. And I think there's a real virtue in that on one level. Those are the kinds of books that I tend to like to read, you know, Barbara Pym and Ann Tyler and those sorts of writers. But if I'm doing it, I think, God, this is so shallow and insignificant. Then, you know, I really should be writing about, you know, global issues.
Did you ever try it?
No. Well, you know, I try to slip in a few observations here and there that seem to have some greater significance than the daily lives of these characters.
Your novel, The Object of My Affection, was made into a movie, was it like 1998 or something?
Yeah, exactly.
With Jennifer Aniston and Paul Rudd. So, like, are you buddies with them? does it make you good friends when they star in an adaptation of your book?
not exactly. I went to see a play in Vermont that had Tim Daly, who's also in the movie, in it. And I went up afterwards and I introduced myself. And he said, "Well, you know, we were all told not to read the book because we were just find it confusing, because the movie was so different from the book that, you know, there were characters who weren't in the book, and there were characters in the book, of course, who weren't in the movie, and everyone's motivation was entirely different." So no. I feel a little bit guilty because, you know, every time Jennifer Aniston's life takes a difficult turn, like, you know, Brad Pitt leaves her for Angelina Jolie, the movie shows up on TV again. And there's this tiny, tiny little spike in book sales. So I'm sort of secretly a little bit pleased, even though I don't wish her any, you know, bad luck, of course. But
Stephen McCauley, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Stephen McCauley's new novel is called Alternatives to Sex. Coming up, three myths that have been used to justify layoffs. We talk with Louis Uchitel about his new book, The Disposable American. This is Fresh Air. Layoffs became a mass phenomenon in American life about two decades ago. Until then, writes Louis Uchitel, companies tried to avoid layoffs. They were a sign of corporate failure and a violation of acceptable business behavior. In Uchitel's new book, The Disposable American, he examines how layoffs became standard management practice and what the consequences have been. Uchitel is an economics reporter for The New York Times. He describes three myths that have been used to justify layoffs. For example, corporations promised that layoffs would eventually have a payoff for America.
The idea of a payoff for America is that on the horizon, once we get our companies efficient, the layoffs will stop and we will reach an equilibrium in which everyone has job security again. And that was a promise that was much stated 10 or 15 years ago. It has never been realized because the layoffs go on. In fact, they seem to get more frequent as the years pass, and the promised equilibrium in which layoffs stop in a very efficient society never materializes or has not materialized.
Let me get to something else that you say is a myth, and that is that laid-off workers must save themselves, that they've lost their job because their value to their employers was less than their cost in wages and benefits, so they must raise their value with more education and training. Why is that a myth?
Well, what we have embraced in America is an individualism. And it says, in effect, people, as the global economy or the more efficient and the more computerized economy comes into place, people have to equip themselves to deal with it. And if they don't, or if they're in jobs that don't require skill, they're subject to losing the jobs. But all they have to do is avail themselves of education and training, and they will equip themselves to be to qualify for the good jobs that are out there. The myth in this is that there aren't enough good jobs out there for all the qualified people. But we like the thought that education and training will re-equip you for another job and give you the promised security in the workforce. It's politically easier to deal with. It takes the government off the hook. It takes unions off the hook, for that matter, and it certainly takes the companies off the hook. You blame the worker.
Another statement that you say is a myth, and that is the pros and cons of layoffs are entirely measurable in dollars and cents. You write in your book, you were actually surprised to find how great the psychological costs of layoffs are.
Yes. When I started this book, I did not expect to find so much psychological damage. People are are interpreting a layoff in America today as a statement that they lack value, and it's a considerable blow to self-esteem. We all have a sort of a life narrative that feeds into our sense of ourselves. Work is one of them, and this declaration that you don't have value destroys that, and as various psychiatrists have told me, it triggers sort of dormant personality traits that would lay dormant all your life if you didn't have this sort of a traumatic trigger, if you will.
In looking how we got to the point that we're at today, where layoffs are so large and so common, you go back to 1981 and you look at the air traffic controller strike. Why do you think that strike is a turning point in the history of American layoffs?
It was one of the barriers that I mentioned to layoffs was the idea that you could go out on strike and have your job back when the strike was finally settled. You didn't have to be afraid to go out on strike because you would be replaced with a replacement, with someone who took your job permanently. And that barrier came down with Reagan's decision in 1981 to replace 11,000 striking air traffic controllers in one fell swoop and replace them with people who were new to the industry. And those air traffic controllers never came back. It was a trauma for the union movement. Almost immediately afterwards, the number of strikes declined because Reagan had, in effect, announced that replacement workers who were technically legal, they could be hired legally to permanently replace strikers, but no company had dared to do that or had done it very infrequently. There was a norm against it. Reagan broke that norm with that decision, and it was one of the turning points. It was one of the barriers that came down and opened the way to acquiescence to layoffs.
Something else that you note in the same year is that Jack Welch became the head of GE, 1981. You described GE as the company that invented the modern American layoff. What do you mean?
Well, Jack Welch came in with a very interesting concept. He saw that he couldn't compete with every overseas supplier of the products that General Electric made. So he decided that he would keep the companies that did the best, that were the most profitable, spin off or sell the companies that were the least profitable, and acquire companies that looked like they had a good future to them. And he just, every time he acquired or sold some operation, there were layoffs. It helped to pay for the layoffs because money had to be borrowed very often to fund the layoffs, and it was a way of adjusting staff. And he was successful with General Electric with this acquisition and merger activity. And because he was successful, he became a model for other companies that also got into this buying and selling of companies. And that was another barrier down. But the people who paid for those acquisitions, for the debt that was often floated, were the workers whose salaries were cut, labor costs were cut, and the money channeled, if you will, into the costs of the acquisition.
My guest is Louis Uchitel. His new book is called The Disposable American, Layoffs and Their Consequences. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Louis Uchitel. He's an economics writer for the New York Times, and his new book is called The Disposable American, Layoffs and Their Consequences. Now, cities tried to lure big corporations to set up headquarters or factories in their areas because it's good jobs, it's good for the economy. And that's what Indianapolis tried to do when it lured United Airlines to build an aircraft maintenance center there. And Indianapolis was actually competing with over 90 other cities. Indianapolis won. United, you know, opened up this maintenance center there. So what did Indianapolis have to do to compete well enough to get United to choose their city?
All right, well, keep in mind first that United had decided to build this maintenance center. Having decided, it went out and said, well, what's the best deal we can get from the various competing cities? The best deal they could get was Indianapolis, and with the contribution of the city and the state, Indianapolis and Indiana, which put up well over $250 million floating a bond issue, and which turned out to be nearly half the cost of the maintenance center. In short, United, having decided to build the maintenance center, got a bunch of cities to compete and got one of the cities, Indianapolis, to bid enough to pay for almost half the center.
And what did Indianapolis think it was going to get out of this?
The promise from United, a sort of commitment, was that there would be more than 5,000 mechanics jobs created, aviation mechanics, never mind the other jobs. These were in those days middle class jobs, and Indianapolis was looking forward to the infusion of more than 5,000 mechanics living with their families middle class lives. That's quite a bit of support for the city.
What did Indianapolis get out of it?
They got, in the best moment, 2,500 mechanics living in the city and the suburbs, spending their money, enriching the economy, and then
that's about half of what they were expecting.
That was half of what they were expecting, and it was at that point there were a labor dispute developed between United and its mechanics, and what had been going extremely well turned and went in the other direction.
And United eventually shut down that center. So what was the lesson to you in terms of cities luring companies through financial incentives?
I think it's money wasted. It's close to $30 billion a year that we spend on what amounts to a zero-sum game. For the nation as a whole, it didn't make any difference whether the jobs were in Indianapolis or in Denver or in some other city that bid for the maintenance center. The jobs would have existed one way or the other. And what we've done then is divert tax money to a zero-sum game, tax money that should be spent on teachers and schools and other services. I think I once figured out that you could hire, I don't know how many thousands of teachers for the amount of money that we spend, $30 billion a year. All the communities in America spend competing with each other trying to get good jobs.
We hear a lot about the global economy, and a lot of economies have moved their plants to other countries. A lot of companies have outsourced part of their operations, whether that's 800-number phone calls or typing or reading MRIs. Do you think that's driving down the wages of the people in America who remain employed?
Well, it's a factor, but we shouldn't let it get out of hand. If you were to the actual number of, they call it offshoring, jobs that have left the country while it's rising and rising rather rapidly is still much smaller than the outsourcing that takes place within the country. That is to the south, to less expensive cities, or they don't go, or there's no outsourcing at all. There are arrangements made with people to keep their jobs in a community, in a plant, but at a lower wage. Caterpillar is an example of that, the two-tier wage. The veterans continue to get the old wage until they retire, and the new people come in at a much lower scale. And that's going on not just at Caterpillar, but in the auto industry, it's going on regularly in Michigan in many small parts companies that are represented by the UAW. The quid pro quo is that the UAW keeps its membership.
Well, you know, another example of very well-educated people being laid off is in your industry, the newspaper industry. There's been so many layoffs in newspapers. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, in part a lot of reporters who are very well educated, who are very good at what they do and are losing their jobs. What's it like to see what you're writing about hit your own industry?
It's not fun. It's not fun to see. I must say the New York Times goes at this as well as anyone does. It works through buyouts as much as possible. And they are voluntary buyouts. The Guild comes in and helps negotiate the nature of the buyouts so that, for the most part, the people who are leaving are people who more or less want to leave. It's still disconcerting, but I've written a book that is not about stopping layoffs. I can't do that. The global economy is not to be denied. Our hegemony that we once had that allowed us to have any number of workers is gone, and there is competition. But on the margin, we've gone too far. We've made layoffs too commonplace, too easy, and in the process, we have not, as a people, said, now, look, we have this situation. We can't employ everybody. How do we do it? How do we take every stakeholder into account? And that's what we're not doing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this very much.
Louis Uchitel is an economics reporter for the New York Times. His new book is called The Disposable American. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from TIAA Craft, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greater good. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art and its current exhibition of paintings by Edvard Munch, MOMA.org. And from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, exactly what is in a chicken McNugget? And how free are so-called free-range chickens? Michael Pollan compares industrial food, the organic food industry, and the organic food movement. He's written a new book called The Omnivore's Dilemma. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.